This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi everyone, so I'm Indy. I was the Jodcast producer before Ben and Charlie and handed it over to them, and they decided to do Jodcast Live, which I would never have been able to do in a million years. So thanks guys. So yes, Chris, you haven't said enough in this Jodcast Live, so we've decided to have an interview with you now. But actually, looking back through the Jodcast archives, you're the most appropriate guest I think we could have gotten, because we followed you and you followed us all the way through our history. So I'm going to start off with all the research I did last night about all your appearances. So your first interview was all the way back in April 2007.
Was that a national astronomy meeting?
Not even, no. That was just a plain old vanilla Jodcast interview with Stuart.
I think it was recorded at the National Astronomy Meeting.
Yeah.
It might not have been on the NAM episode,
it's how Stuart and I met.
Okay.
Yep. Well, there you go.
This is information I was not privy to.
This is vital for the Jodcast archives.
Absolutely. We need to put this history down. And you were introduced as Chris Lintott of Sky at Night fame. And for people who followed Chris's interviews and things he talks about on TV, surprisingly, there was no mention of Galaxy Zoo at all.
Well, not that, so it didn't exist.
Exactly.
Was before we'd come up with the wonderful idea of getting other people to do our work for us. Inviting people to help us explore the universe via classifying galaxies. So April, yeah, we will have had the idea. In fact, we would have been trying to build the first Galaxy Zoo website. But at that point, we thought this was a crazy idea. The idea that anyone would volunteer their time to sort through astronomical data was nonsense. And so I thought this was a side project, not the thing I was going to spend the next most of 10 years doing.
Yeah, it's brilliant, because we then sort of see the evolution of your side project over the years. So there's a second interview quite shortly afterwards, in August 2007, where there you start to mention it. This one was done on the phone for some reason. Stuart, any back info?
Well, we have no budget, so we can't go anywhere.
So it sounds a bit like a radio interview. It's quite funny. And I have got this fantastic quote that you... So Stuart starts and says, we talked about Galaxy Zoo a little bit at NAMM, but that was just an idea. And then you say, yes, it was a stray beam of light in a telescope at the time.
Blimey. I was obviously more poetic back then.
And so that was the first mention of Galaxy Zoo on the Jodcast. Your next appearance wasn't even as an interviewer. You were just a co-presenter at the NAMM in Belfast in 2008.
I think that was lack of budget again. They couldn't afford enough Jodcast people, but
so
I
had to
rope
you
in
to interview other people. The next one was slightly after that in May 2008, because there were some very interesting things that started to come out of Galaxy Zoo, and namely Hanni's vulva.
This enormous gas cloud, which we now think had been excited by a jet of material associated with a black hole in a nearby galaxy, which at the time we probably thought of as a big green blob that was mysterious.
Pretty much, you had it kind of on the nose. It was all quite hypothetical at the time, but I think looking at what was then deemed, so I thought the name was really cool. I hadn't actually heard of this, but it's a quasar ionization echo, which sounds really cool.
Yes, it sounds like something they would have run away from in Star Trek.
and then we've just invited you back periodically to update us on Galaxy Zoo and then what became the Zooniverse. So clearly you're at Jodcast Live, as has been mentioned earlier in the program. And then we have the first mention of the Zooniverse, which was at NAMM 2012, when we interviewed you along with Rob Simpson, who's behind the Planet Hunters initiative. And so that was the first branching out of the Zooniverse into something else.
We'd done a few other things along the way, but Planet Hunters, I think, was important to us. So this is, you can still go and look for planets in data from a space telescope called Kepler. And I think Planet Hunters was important to us for two reasons. The first one was that we still had the idea that with Galaxy Zoo, when we're showing people pictures of galaxies, that people were helping us in their tens of thousands because they liked looking at pictures of galaxies. And Planet Hunters aimed to build on that success by having people look at graphs for fun. Because you can't see these extrasolar planets. All you could do is look at a star and wait for the planet to get in the way of it, and you get a blink. And so Planet Hunters was visual inspection of graphs. And it's still, I think, it's certainly in the top three. It's probably our most successful project. And we suddenly clicked that we really had hard evidence that our army of volunteers out there on the web weren't doing this because the pictures were pretty. They were doing it because the ideas were pretty. And the idea that you could sit in front of a web browser and try and discover something about the universe was hugely inspiring. And suddenly for me, I realized that we were doing the wrong thing, I think, often in talking about astronomy. We're busy telling you what we know, and actually what's exciting is what we don't know. That's what I said a minute ago. And Planet Hunters was the thing that confirmed that. So that's the first reason it was important. The second one is that I'm one of the few, I think, professional astronomers who grew up as an amateur astronomer. My guess is there were a few others on the Jodcast team, but it might be a selection effect. But I grew up as an amateur astronomer, and the 12-year-old me would have been so impressed that we tried to find planets. And so I felt that was a promise repaid to my past self to do something as cool as trying to find a planet.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So continuing with the Jodcast history, then we kind of lost interest in you for a while. and then your last interview, which was your sixth, was about a year ago. And it was just we were just trying to find out what you'd done in the previous three. So it was just a long, sort of Zooniverse, oriented interview. And I'll get back to that in a second. But one of the really cool things that you've been doing with the Zooniverse since 2012 and the Planet Hunters was you've been partnering with Stargazing Live every year, and you've had a different project, and you basically use the exposure to tell people, come to our website and classify all these things. And
yeah,
so,
I sometimes tell people that we make Brian Cox useful for astronomers, but I've been told to stop saying that. But it's exactly, this is exactly the point. You know, the Stargazing Live audience who are wonderful are there because they're mildly curious about this place and about Brian and about Dara and about whatever's happened, whether it's comets or Pluto or Tim Peake or whatever. And so to say to that large an audience, you can help us, is incredible. And then to nearly kill ourselves because we always try and give the results during Stargazing Live. So I think my favourite was one from a few years ago, a project called Space Warps, which looks for distant galaxies, galaxies whose light has been bent by passing through space and actually close to a nearby galaxy. So you get this warped and distorted image. And so we were here, we put our site up, we said on the first night of Stargazing Live, go, help us find a distant galaxy. People rushed off. We got a million classifications in 20 minutes. And by the time the program had gone off the air the first night, we had a good candidate gravitational lens. And so we spent the next day trying to work out what we could say about this. And so with any astronomical discovery, as soon as you see something new, a bit like the green blob we had earlier, the first question is, how far away is it? And we were sitting in what becomes the green room, sort of for Stargazing Live, but is actually, I think, one of the postdoc offices. So I don't know who we turf out every year. But we were sitting there, and I said to the room, I said, what we really need is a world-class radio telescope. And the entire room sort of very slowly looked out the window. And we thought this was fine, so I went to talk to Tim O'Brien. I said, I know you're busy, you know, live TV show and all that. Can we use the Lovell? And it's not scheduled during Stargazing Live, because we wouldn't inflict the BBC's radio interference on a normal astronomy project. And so we used the Lovell during the show to follow up on this discovery, which ruined the shot. It was pointing away from the window. And then some people here at Jodrell worked all night to build a software program that could filter out the effects of having a live television show from your radio telescope. And we worked throughout the next day, and we got in my hands a print of a radio picture of this distant galaxy 90 seconds before I showed it.
Ink still wet. On,
yeah, absolutely. And I kept getting messages from the Space Warps team, particularly Phil Marshall, who's in Stanford. It's his birthday today, incidentally. I noticed he has the same birthday celebration as the Jodcast. But kept emailing me and saying, well, can we see this result? I said, no, we'll get it to you. And eventually, afterwards, he said, it was really clever that you showed it to the audience at the same time as us, because we're all the same team. I said, Phil, I just didn't have it. I didn't have time to email you. But that collaboration of the BBC to get the audience, the wonderful Zooniverse team who don't sleep for the week of Stargazing Live, because one way to test your website is to have Brian Cox point 4 million people at it. And then the astronomers and the science team, particularly here, to get the result out. It was just wonderful. And the thing turns out to be it's a star-forming galaxy observed about 9 billion years ago. And it's a really interesting system that's still being followed up.
That's fantastic. I love it because it's sort of science accelerated. It's like something you just add loads of people and it just...
Yeah, which is what the Zooniverse does as well, right? I mean, we often say that a good Zooniverse project is one where you find yourself sitting in a coffee room and saying, you know, I'd like to do this project, but somebody would have to do this. You know, some PhD student would have to look through a million images. Well, we could do that in an afternoon. And it's that acceleration is exactly the right word to describe what's happening.
So let's talk a bit more about the Zooniverse project in its current state. So first of all, I've got a really crucial question. Why do so many things begin with P in the Zooniverse? We've got plankton, penguins, pulsars, planets.
Yeah, mostly a love of alliteration, really. I adore alliteration. And no, it wasn't funny, thank you. Not even Dave laughed at that.
Sorry.
But no, I mean... I don't have a sensible answer, but it does illustrate how many different things we've ended up doing. We realised that if we built a system for people to look at galaxies and to look for planets, that it's useful for other researchers as well. In fact, these days, if you are a researcher, you can build your own project in the Zooniverse with a few clicks, because it's not just astronomers that have this problem of having too much data or too many images.
Sure.
Amongst the most fun have been the ecology ones. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that whereas... Just as in the old days, an astronomy PhD student studying galaxies might go and take 10 photographic plates and bring them back and study them, we now have access to a million images, whereas ecologists used to go into the field and keep notes on the behaviour of animals. They now can put cameras out and come back with millions of images of lions or penguins or whatever it is, often not in the same project, those two examples. And if anyone sees on our project. And so that acceleration of data has happened there too. And just like in astronomy, our ability to collect data has got ahead of our ability to analyze it. And the solution is to get help.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. So I was going to say... Yes, so I have you on record as saying that your favourite... So the A, picking your favourite Zooniverse project is like picking your favourite child.
It is.
No, but you gave us an answer last time, and you said it was the plankton project.
Yes.
Is that still...
I hope what I said was that the plankton one was the one that I did to relax, because I found them strangely fascinating.
You did mention that. I think you mentioned something about one of the plankton looking like the alien.
The alien from Alien.
You found it? You hadn't found it like a year
ago. No, I still haven't found it. They're very rare, as it turns out. No, I've been distracted by penguins.
That's a great segue. Thanks. That's a great job for me. Because you've actually just gone to see penguins in Antarctica, haven't you, recently? So tell us about... that trip and what you actually did and why you weren't doing astronomy but looking at penguins instead.
Sorry, after 7 interviews it becomes what did you do on your holidays? I assume this means I finally answered all the astronomy questions, so that's good. But no, I went on holiday to Antarctica, but I went as an unpaid research assistant for the Penguin Watch team, who maintain a network of cameras down there, and every year they have to go and change the batteries on the camera and get the data card out to bring back their images of penguins. So I had great fun, mostly slipping and sliding in the wake of the biologists as they ran up hills to get to the cameras. But Ben, somebody asked me for a picture of myself in Antarctica, which the viewers can now see on the background. And I picked a picture with no penguins in it, partly because this makes for an easy classification. The correct answer here is 0 penguins. But also, the thing that I'm clutching, which is a stone wall, it has some physics significance. So this is a place called Port Chaquot. No one's ever heard of Chaquot. He was a French explorer who was the first to deliberately spend a winter in Antarctica. There'd been a crew before him who'd accidentally spent a winter in Antarctica. But he was there with his crew. He had a certain sense of style, as you'd expect from a French explorer. He took his butler with him. And there's a photo of him in about where I am in this picture, having a champagne breakfast in front of his ship. But the thing that I'm touching is called the magnetic hut. And one of the things that the early Antarctic explorers were trying to do was to map the Earth's magnetic field in the south. because people probably know that the magnetic poles of the Earth are not situated on the rotational poles. So if you go to the geographical north or south poles, your compass will still point in a direction. They point to the magnetic north and south, which are offset. And the south one is all the way over towards New Zealand. And if you think about it, this is why New Zealand gets good aurora, even though they're much closer to the equator than we are in the UK. And so they were looking on the, this is in the wrong side of the continent, and they took all the equipment there, they built a stone hut, they set up the thing, and they failed to find the South Magnetic Pole.
This
is on the other side. But Shoka was a scientific expedition, and I think actually one of the things I loved about my holiday was following in the footsteps of these people who were trying to do science in some really quite extreme conditions. They took a botanist as well, because they didn't know they were going to a place where there were no plants.
And so sounds like science to me.
Yeah, he ended up writing a novel rather than studying plants, because he couldn't. So I thought that would inspire the PhD students on the team. You know, if your science isn't going well, then novels are a way forward.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I'm here because it's basically a break from writing my own PhD thesis, which is a month away from deadline, so I might just run away to Antarctica. And
yep, I recommend it. Charcot's second ship, his first was the Francois, but the second one was called the Pourquoi Pas, which is the why not. Which I think shows the measure of the man.
Pretty much, that's really good. So I'm gonna get told off by Sally if I don't mention the Pulsar Hunters project. Because that happened here about a month ago now, and as you say, so it was sort of a few sleepless nights for all the scientists involved. And it was your first real brush of pulsars, I think,
despite being
an astronomer, yeah.
Yes, not all astronomers do pulsars. I know that here at Jodrell that's a controversial statement. I guess here astronomers are divided into those who study pulsars and those who should study pulsars. I've been the latter. But no, it's this thing of, well, we're not looking at images, but we're looking at data, which shows an idea. And we wanted to do something that was very tied to Jodrell. You know, I think the Stargazing Live program gets a lot of the love it does from the audience, because it's here. It's about being in this iconic place. I'm sitting in a lovely room, but I'm really talking about the dish outside. And so we wanted to do that, and we had data. So we wanted to do this idea of data and then follow-up, and to work with some of the astronomers here. So we had a great response, and people sorted through the data, and we found some things to talk about. And we're in that sort of middle stage where we're still working through what's in that data and what people have helped us find. I think what's interesting about pulsar hunting from a Zooniverse point of view is that the task is completely overwhelming, even if you've got a million people. And so what you need to do is you need to use a combination of people and computers.
Right.
And typically at the minute, we sort of use, what we did for Stargazing Live was use the computers and then use the people. But I think actually where we'll get to is a much more dynamic thing. So data will come off a telescope and will automatically decide what's worth showing to people and what's worth showing to computers, and then the computers will learn from the people, and we'll get this nice virtuous cycle going. Brilliant. And Pulsar Hunters, really, although it found some pulsars, and that's very exciting, is also providing us with data on how to do that well. And that's crucial for things like LSST and the future generations of surveys that we've got coming.
Okay, yeah, so that brings us... So we're almost done now, so I'm just going to ask you this sort of final question.
By which you mean, can I make my answer shorter than all of the others?
Also, yes. It's two questions. One is, do you have any idea what will be the Zooniverse project on Stargazing Live next year? And the other one is, where does the Zooniverse go next? So you've kind of answered that already, but maybe...
Well, the answer to the first one is no. So we're in the awkward stage in which the BBC are talking about what might or might not happen, and I'm trying to avoid them so that we don't have to decide until we've actually had a chance to recover.
Yep.
I think where the Zooniverse is going is to be cleverer. So to both involving computers, but even amongst people, to be able to say to you each individually, I need your help to look at this thing right now. And maybe that's an alert you get two or three times a day and your phone pops up a galaxy or a picture of a set of penguins or whatever. But just being able to get to the point, instead of saying collectively, can we all sort through these images, just those small moments of actually, I need you over there right now to look at this image because I know that you're the best person online in the world to help me with this specific thing right now. That turns out to be an interesting problem. Somebody said earlier that people are much more complicated than pulsars, and I describe where I've done it, where I've gone in the last 8 years or so, is discovering that galaxies are simple. And it's understanding the people in the universe that's the hard bit.
Great. Yep, I think that's the time. So thanks a lot for the interview, Chris, and see you back for your eighth.
Thank you.